And psychedelics are experiencing a renaissance. It locked in the drugs cabinet in a haze of moral panic in the 60s. Drugs like LSD, MDMA and magic mushrooms are now offering promising results in the treatment of PTSD, depression and addiction. Rick Doblin has been at the forefront of efforts to lead these drugs out of exile in the US, and he's the founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS for short. And his 2019 TED Talk about his work has nearly 2 million views. And Rick Doblin joins me now. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, first and foremost, I guess we should ask where your lifelong interest in the therapeutic benefits of psychedelics actually came from.
Well, I would say it came out of desperation and fear. I was born in 53. I'm from a Jewish family. I was very much educated at a young age about the Holocaust, and that just terrified me about, you know, how dehumanization and scapegoating and the irrational taking over rational thought. And, you know, my father was a doctor. We were, you know, materially quite comfortable, but at the same time, we could fall victim to sort of psychological factors. And then as I was growing up, I was also a young boy during the Cuban Missile Crisis when we were taught about duck and cover, you know, in case the Russians and the U.S., you know, launch nuclear war, just hide under your desk. And, you know, when you're a 9 or 10 year old boy, that's not very reassuring, or an adult either. And then for me, the final confrontation with that was the Vietnam War. And I was a draft resistor. I was prepared to go to jail instead of go to Vietnam. But all of these things pointed to me to psychological factors that really it's a crisis of spirituality, a crisis of mental health. And that led me to be thinking about tools that could be helpful to people to process their shadow, their what they project onto others. And then when I started taking psychedelics, which was when I was just 17 years old, in 1971 and then in 72, and I learned a lot about them, but it was difficult. I was having very difficult experiences. And so I went to the guidance counselor at my college, at New College of Florida, and he was sympathetic. And he gave me this book to read by Stanislav Grof called Realms of the Human Unconscious, Observations from LSD Research. And it was reading that book that really transformed my life, that process of using tools to bring up the shadow, to bring up things from the unconscious, and also spiritual experiences and a sense of connection. I thought that that was the antidote to fundamentalism and to dehumanization, is if we can all feel how much we're part of a much bigger thing, we're part of life on Earth, and that we're part of this process of growth and evolution, this universe that goes deeper than what ways we normally identify ourselves in terms of our country or our religion or our race or our gender or socioeconomic status, that if we could feel how we're all connected at a deeper level, then we'll more appreciate differences rather than be scared from them. And so once I realized the potential of psychedelics, I also realized that there was this massive backlash that had criminalized them and was wiping out psychedelic research all over the world. And so out of fear and desperation at age 18, I said, I'm going to devote myself to becoming a psychedelic therapy and trying to bring back psychedelic research.
Well, that was a very evolved thought pattern for somebody who was 17, 18. And, of course, you're coming up against society, because in the mid-60s, Timothy Leary said, turn on, tune in and drop out. And O'Leary said in his 1983 autobiography that he didn't actually mean it to be interpreted as get stoned and abandon all constructive activity. he saw it as a sequence of personal development, and drugs, and I presume he was talking about psychedelics, were one way to accomplish, he used the words, activation, consciousness and a commitment to self-reliance. And I guess that's how you see it.
Yeah, and actually, I did drop out of college for 10 years after I took LSD and realized that the research was shut down. And it was necessary for me to spend that 10 years trying to integrate the experiences that I had before. But I always knew that I wanted to go back to school, and I wanted to kind of come out from this underground and mainstream psychedelics. And I felt that that kind of time out was important for me. But the time back in, the goal to reintegrate, is what's crucial to me. And I think there was one meeting. I've got to know Timothy Leary pretty well. And in a conference that was a benefit for MAPS in 1990, he was one of the speakers. And this, I think, will epitomize, you know, the differences, is that when I was after his talk, I asked him for some suggestions that he might have for those of us that are really trying to do the psychedelic research, to work with the FDA, to bring this back to medicine, and then through beyond that to the wider culture. And so I asked him, you know, what kind of advice do you have for us in dealing with the government? And his initial rapid response was, "F*** government." He said, "I am so far beyond asking for permission for anything, but I'm glad you're doing it." So, and then he held up my hand and kind of like the passing of the torch. So I feel that there was this, even though he did talk about being misinterpreted, he really did identify as a rebel, as a counterculture hero, as question authority, challenge the systems.
Do you think he rewrote his own history, Rick?
Oh, my God, for sure he did. I mean, I've done long-term follow-up studies to two of the projects that he did at Harvard. One was the Good Friday Experiment, which was the first effort in 1962 to look at whether psilocybin could actually produce spiritual experiences when taken by religiously inclined people in a religious setting. I did a 25-year follow-up to that. And then I did a 35-year follow-up to the Concord Prison Experiment that Tim and Ralph Metzner and others did, where they wanted to see if they could give prisoners who were close to being released, either on probation or the end of their sentences, if they could give them psilocybin and a spiritual experience in prison and then help reduce recidivism once they got out by providing more pro-social motivation. And in these follow-up studies, I did find a fair amount of revisionism of what actually happened. So that was very disappointing.
Yes, it wasn't the path that you were on. Tell us about MAPS. MAPS stands for the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies.
Yeah, so MAPS is basically a nonprofit pharmaceutical company focused on psychedelics and cannabis. That's the best way to understand it. And when I dropped out of college in 1972, it took 10 years for me to integrate and get ready. And I started college in 82, and I went for a workshop, a month-long workshop with Stan Groff at a place called Esalen. And that's where I learned about MDMA. And MDMA was still legal. It was used as a therapy drug, quietly though, but it had also just started to become ecstasy, used in public and recreational settings. And so it was clear that it was doomed. This was the time of Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan, the escalation of the drug war and Just Say No. So I felt I learned about LSD after the backlash, but I learned about MDMA before the backlash. And then I started getting involved to try to protect the therapeutic use of MDMA. I started a nonprofit before MAPS. And in 84, when the DEA moved to criminalize ecstasy, we had prepared the psychedelic therapy community. And I went to Washington and filed for a hearing. And eventually we got the hearing and we won the hearing. The DEA administrative law judge said it should stay in Schedule 3, which means MDMA should still be a medicine, but illegal otherwise. But the administrator of the DEA rejected the recommendation. We won a couple times in the appeals courts. Eventually, we lost. But it was clear at that point that the only way to bring the therapeutics of MDMA back was through the FDA. So in 86 is when I started MAPS with the goal of trying to work with FDA and do the research and bring MDMA into a fully legal prescription medicine context. And again, I should emphasize, though, that it's MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. The drug is not the treatment. It's the drug assists psychotherapy. So it's a therapeutic approach that's facilitated by MDMA. And now we're 33 years past that. I didn't know how long it would take or how hard it would be or how expensive it would be. But we're in the midst of phase 3 studies, the final stage of research. And we anticipate by 2021, 2022, we should have FDA approval. And we're also expanding to Europe to work through Europe, and Australia and New Zealand are places that we also want to do research and bring the prescription use of MDMA pretty much all over the world. So we now have about 65 people working for MAPS, all supported for donations. And it's quite a big operation, and about 84 therapists that we work with. And we do a lot of public education and other projects as well. But the essence of it is a nonprofit pharmaceutical company.
Well, how did you get the legal permission to do this?
So I have a master's and PhD from Harvard, from the Kennedy School of Government. So after I dropped out of college for 10 years and I went back to college to study to be a psychedelic psychotherapist, I graduated in 87 and I wanted to get a clinical psych PhD to learn how to do psychotherapy outcome research, which is what we're doing now, to demonstrate the value of psychedelics. And I was able to get a bachelor's degree in psychology and transpersonal psychology and psychedelic research. But when I went to go to get into a clinical psych PhD program, nobody would let me in because in the 80s, the research was still shut down. So that's where I realized the politics was in the way of the science, and so I needed to switch and study the politics. And so I managed to get into Harvard, to the Kennedy School of Government. And so that's where I learned how to get legal permission for this research. So what we're doing is all entirely above board. It's, as I said, a nonprofit pharmaceutical company. We work heavily with the FDA, with the Drug Enforcement Administration, with institutional review boards, and we are moving to further legitimize psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy by getting prescription approval for MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. And we're collaborating with those people that are trying to work with psilocybin and ibogaine and other drugs.
What is it about MDMA specifically in a therapeutic setting that you've found that works? What happens to people when they're in a controlled environment like that? Because there's a big difference between recreational use, party time, and actually going into therapy, isn't there?
There's a very big difference. And in fact, some of the therapists that we're training, we have a protocol from FDA where we give MDMA to therapists as part of their training. And several of these therapists have tried MDMA before in recreational settings, but when they do it in a therapeutic setting, they say it's completely different. The focus in a therapy setting is inward. We do it with people who are basically, it's an eight-hour therapy session with a male-female team. People's eyes are closed. Usually they're listening to music. They're having very metaphorical, poetic, imaginary, imagery-rich experiences that reflect conflicts or issues in their lives. And roughly half the 8 hours, they're doing that. The other half the time, more or less, they're speaking with the therapists. But what MDMA actually does is pretty well known. So if somebody were to go to Medline, which is the repository of the world's medical scientific information and papers, there's over 5,000 papers on MDMA or ecstasy. And so basically what it does is it reduces activity in the fear processing part of our brain, which is called the amygdala, so that emotions, feelings, thoughts that were more fraught with fear are muted, so that you can look at memories, you can recall certain things without your normal fear response. That's also why it's such a powerful, widespread, popular recreational drug, because it's really good for relationships, for difficult emotional discussions. MDMA also increases activity in the prefrontal cortex, where we think logically. And it increases activity between the hippocampus, where we store things into long-term memory, and the amygdala. So basically what happens is that under the influence of MDMA, difficult emotions are able to be looked at and experienced in a more fluid way. People are able to think more rationally about it, and temporally they're able to put these experiences in the past. The problem with trauma is that it's PTSD, it's always like it's about to happen, or it's happening, you know, and any kind of noise or triggers remind people of the trauma. So in addition to all that, MDMA stimulates the production of oxytocin. So that's the hormone for nursing mothers, for when you're in love, for orgasm. It's this hormone of connection and togetherness, and MDMA stimulates that. There was just an incredible paper published in Nature, one of the top scientific journals in the world, that looked at mice who were given MDMA, and it showed that they released oxytocin, and the oxytocin actually promotes neural connections in these pro-social areas of the brain. So you're actually helping people to develop and strengthen these emotions, these pro-social emotions. And the same team at Johns Hopkins gave MDMA to some octopuses. And it turns out 550 million years ago or so, humans and octopuses diverged. Octopuses still process serotonin, though, and they are very asocial creatures unless it's mating season. But these researchers figured out how to give the right dose to an octopus by soaking it in water that's got MDMA in it for 10 minutes. And then they put them in an experimental context, and they find that they're much more pro-social. So these kind of pro-social activities of MDMA are so deep in our evolutionary history, they're pre-verbal, that I think this drug has just got this really profound impact that's very helpful for building the therapeutic alliance, for helping people trust again, but mostly for helping people really look at challenging, difficult emotions in a more rational and open-hearted way.
First of all, just from what you've said, some people may look at that octopus experiment as animal cruelty, of course.
Well, the octopuses seem quite happy to get MDMA.
And secondly, for people listening and who are anti-drugs, they'll just be hearing the message that it should be legal, MDMA should be legal, and we should all be able to take whatever we like. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that it's appropriate to be anti-drug abuse, but it's completely misguided to be anti-drug. Because the fundamental problem with the drug war is that we invest substances in properties. This is a good drug, that's a bad drug, when it's about the relationship that we have with the drug. So the best example is the drug thalidomide, which was prescribed for morning sickness in the 50s and 60s, caused incredible birth defects, and was banned in the U.S., once this connection was realized. The only person at the FDA that ever won the U.S. Presidential Medal of Honor was this woman, Frances Kelsey, that blocked the approval of thalidomide in the United States. But thalidomide is now a prescription medicine. It's used for certain kinds of cancers, for leprosy. So it's not an evil substance. When it's used by pregnant women for morning sickness, it causes terrible birth defects. But when it's used in different contexts to treat certain kinds of cancers, it's life-saving. So I think for those people that are anti-drug, I would just suggest that let's form a common alliance on drug abuse and how we help that. But being against the drugs themselves is very misguided. The other thing I'll say is that when we talk about MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, it's a 3.5-month treatment process. People only get MDMA three times, once a month. They get 12 90-minute non-drug psychotherapy sessions, three before the first MDMA and three after each one for integration. And our goal is to help people be without drugs, to move past their PTSD. So Big Pharma gives SSRIs and other drugs for PTSD that are meant to be taken on a daily basis for months or years or decades sometimes. And when you stop taking them, your problems come back. They just mute the symptoms. So psychedelic assisted psychotherapy is an anti-drug approach because we're trying to free people of the core problem so that they don't need drugs. The other thing I'll say is that MDMA is being studied right now in England for alcoholism. And a lot of what drives drug abuse is people running away from trauma or from difficult experiences. Psilocybin has been shown very effective in the treatment of alcoholism, in nicotine addiction, even in cocaine addiction. A drug called Ibogaine, a psychedelic drug from Western Africa, which has been studied in New Zealand, is actually used for opiate addiction. So the psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy can actually help with drug abuse. And so I would say for those people that are anti-drug, really take a closer look at that.
Is psilocybin one of the active ingredients in LSD?
No. Psilocybin is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms.
Ah, okay.
And so LSD is lysergic acid diethylamide. It's a completely different drug, but LSD and psilocybin are very similar.
In your TED talk, Rick, you talk about a couple of people you've helped. Let's start with Marcella.
Yes. So I was just with Marcella a few weeks ago in 1984. So I said I learned about MDMA in 1982. In 1984, I went back to Esalen to study with Stan Grof and Christina, his wife, for a month. And it was about spiritual emergencies, helping people who were struggling, that were sort of breaking down in their normal life, but that they were not necessarily psychotic or schizophrenic, but they were, you could say, the midlife crisis or whatever. And it was about how to help them. So I was home for a couple days after that, and I got a call from a friend of mine who said that he and his girlfriend had done MDMA, and under the influence of MDMA, a past rape and almost murder came up in her memory. And it was so terrifying for her that she was scared that she would commit suicide. And so she checked herself into a mental institution, and they kept her there for a couple of days. They gave her just the same old drug she'd been given before. She'd been in and out of an institutions before then. And she was more despairing after she got out of the institution than before, because she felt that there was no help for her. And so my friend said, "Is there anything you can do?" And I said, "Well, I don't know that I'm qualified, but it seems that she got no other choices." So I got some women friends of mine, and we developed a therapeutic context. And I spoke to Marcella and said, "As long as you promise not to commit suicide while we're working together, I'll give it a chance." And as it turned out, it helped her. And she kept getting better. So in 1984 is when I really learned that MDMA could be very helpful for PTSD. And as Marcella started healing more and more, she decided that she wanted to help other people, similar situations to hers. And so she went back to school to become a therapist. And now she is one of our lead therapists, and she trains other therapists. So that was 35 years ago. And she is better. And she attributes it to the therapy that she had with MDMA. We also did an LSD MDMA combination. But Marcella is the perfect example of what they call the wounded healer. It's someone who has had emotional wounds of certain kinds, but able to heal themselves, and then they are sympathetic and can help heal other people.
Is this through the insights that they have when they're under the influence of the drug and in the therapy session about their own approach to their problems?
There is a combination of insight and emotional processing. And I think you need both. And a lot of traditional psychotherapy is based on insight, but unless you process the emotions, the insight isn't enough. And so in technical language, it's called fear extinction and memory reconsolidation. And you basically extinguish the fear for a certain memory, a memory of trauma, that you're able to face it. Because what you're recognizing in the therapy situation is that you're in a safe, supportive context. There's people there that are trying to help you. You're not being endangered. And when these memories come up, they're from the past, but they color how you see the present. But often they're like, sunglasses, you could say, that change what you actually see. It's not always that way. And so this memory reconsolidation process is that once you're able to say this incident really took place in the past, it's not happening now, you let out the feelings, when you rebuild the memory in your brain, in a sense, you are swapping out the emotion of the present, which is peacefulness, it's my journey, it's in the past, with the fear that it's always about to happen. So that then after you've reconsolidated the memory, then in the future, when you remember it, you remember the incident, but you've switched out the memory so that you're not terrified by it. And we also find that MDMA increases people's memory of the trauma. They're able to remember more of it. And so these memories that are having this influence on them in an unconscious way, the world is unsafe, I'm about to be attacked, that when you bring them to the light of day and you process them, then you can get better. So a lot of times people are crying, they're shaking, they're letting out the feelings that when the incident happened, they couldn't, because they had to think about their survival. But now they stuff those memories down. And when you can process them in your body and your feelings, combined with insight, it's those two factors that help people get better.
And you also work a lot with veterans and yes. finding great success.
Yes, very much so. The sad part is that more than a year ago, September 2018, the U.S. Veterans Administration had 1,036,000 veterans receiving disability payments for PTSD. Now, not all of them were 100% disabled, different percentages, but over 1 million veterans are disabled to some degree by PTSD. And we don't know how much it costs, but it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 or $15 billion a year. And these are mostly young people who will be around another 50, 60 years. So the enormous financial cost for PTSD, for the military, the enormous burden of suffering, not only the PTSD patients, but their families, the people they're around. And so we have been trying since 1990 to do work inside the VA. And we still have not gotten a penny from the VA or the Department of Defense, but we are getting close after 29 years of effort to funding a study inside the Bronx VA outside of New York City. So it's not a done deal yet, but it's looking really good. Plus, we're also working with all of the, or not all, but the main researchers affiliated with the Veterans Administration who have developed non-drug psychotherapies for PTSD, like prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral conjoint therapy, conjoint meaning couples where one has PTSD and it affects the relationship. And so we are paying actually to blend MDMA with these different therapies as a way to educate the VA about the potential of MDMA. And we think that if this were to have been accepted in 1990, when we first tried to approach the VA, well before the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, if this had been a part of the VA's treatment armamentarium, we wouldn't have more than a million vets right now disabled by PTSD. And we take people that have attempted suicide multiple times. In our studies, we work with the hardest cases. It's severe PTSD. Most PTSD studies exclude people who've attempted suicide in the past, but we don't. And the MDMA helps people face those fears that led them to try to kill themselves. And I think that this can be a major tool in helping the world. That there's so many people traumatized. It's so sad. But the veterans get a lot of support in the United States. And so the fact that we're able to help veterans has gotten us bipartisan support from the Rebecca Mercer, the Mercer family, who supported Trump and Bannon. We have incredible coverage on Fox News. It's a very bipartisan thing. But more people in America have PTSD, women survivors of sexual assault or abuse or childhood violence or accidents or any number of other things. But the veterans get the most attention.
Fascinating, Rick, when you say for future use that you'd like to get into conflict resolution, but not within a family, but between examples, Arabs and Israelis and Catholics and Protestants. That would be remarkable if you could do that.
Yes, it would. Let me add also Republicans and Democrats here in the United States. And yes, because when you can... when you get into these tribalism kind of situations or these long-standing disputes between Jews and Arabs, for example, or Republicans and Democrats, people react irrationally, emotionally, stereotypically. They separate into us and them. And so one part of the psychedelics is this sort of spiritual, mystical sense of connection beyond all these definitions, as I said before. And if you can help people see their commonalities, then they can not have to kill people for the differences. But then the other thing MDMA does is it really helps with multi-generational trauma so that people are not seeing through the lens of past pain and hurt. And I think in these contexts with political conflict resolution, I think MDMA could be tremendously helpful, as could some of the other psychedelics. And we are starting a three-year project. We're almost at the end of the first year with Israelis and Palestinians who have illegally, on their own, done ayahuasca and MDMA together. And so the first year we spent interviewing people. And that was very instructive. And then we're moving now to do a study in years two and three to actually incorporate measures that are used in conflict resolution and communications theories, and to see if we can demonstrate more scientifically what people have been doing on their own. But we go back to the beginning of MDMA. When it was legal, it was used a lot for couples therapy. And that's a form of kind of difficult negotiations. And so it's sort of logical, I think, that we would move from couples therapy to conflict resolution.
And at the end of your TED talk, you said humanity now is in a race between catastrophe and consciousness. What do you think is going to win out?
Well, I'm a very optimistic person, so I believe that consciousness will likely win out. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of stresses. We see a rise of fundamentalism. The environmental crisis, the climate change is going to put more pressure on more people. So there's going to be a temptation to run away from problems and blame others. And that's not a healthy way to do it. And if we look at what is happening right now with President Trump, you couldn't have a better pro-pollution president than Trump, who's really trying to pretend as if climate change isn't happening. Let's just get more coal and more oil out there. So I think there is this struggle, and it's incumbent on all of us to try to get beyond these stereotypes and fear-based emotions and really let it sink deeper and think about our children and think about what we want to accomplish. But I'm very hopeful the solutions are there. It's not that we lack for solutions. It's can we implement them? And the sad thing also is I've been looking at a little bit of history and wondering how many people in Germany, how many Nazis stood by Adolf Hitler all the way through the war until the end? And the answer is an awful lot of them. And so people, when they get into these tribalism kind of states, whatever contrary information is happening, they just disregard it. And so I'd say that is our challenge, is how do we help people handle and process fears, anxieties, hatreds, so that we can build these bridges that we need to help us all survive.
Not all drugs are the same, though, are they, Rick? Hitler being on methamphetamine, that can't be good for consciousness.
Well, methamphetamines provide energy, but they don't open your heart. In fact, we hear about people that take methamphetamine on a consistent basis that you can become more paranoid. And so not all drugs are helpful, obviously. Not all drugs lead to opening of consciousness or the opening of the heart. That's why MDMA is so rare and so unique. But MDMA is methylene dioxymethamphetamine. So we've taken the methamphetamine molecule, not we, but the methamphetamine molecule that Hitler was using and that the German army was using for their blitzkriegs so that they wouldn't sleep for a couple of days, and it promotes aggression. But when you change the molecule, it changes the effect. So MDMA gives the energy and the alertness of methamphetamine, but it makes people more peaceful, more still, more open-hearted. And so I think it's a fundamentally different effect, and it can be very healing.
And what about yourself? Have you taken psychedelics since the 60s? Are they something that you regularly take for your own consciousness?
Well, I didn't. I didn't take them in the 60s because I believed all the propaganda as I was growing up. I thought that LSD hurt your chromosomes, that if you took LSD five or six times, you were certifiably insane. You know, I was just a young boy, so I believed what the media was telling me until I started looking deeper into it when I was 17 and 18. So I have taken psychedelics starting when I was 17 and 18, and I believe that, that there's one school of thought that says once you've got the message, hang up the phone.
And so you know, yes.
a bunch of people that say, oh, okay, I took psychedelics, but now I'm a meditator. My view is that there's a lot of different messages and that as you're aging and as you go through life, there's different questions, different challenges at each stage of life. And so I have found psychedelics to be a very helpful tool throughout my life. Now I'm about to turn 66, and I would imagine that I will continue to do them for as long as I live. But I don't do them very frequently at all, because you don't need to. I mean, they're tools for inspiration, tools for transformation, and the real work is the integration afterwards. So whereas I said, for those people that might be anti-drug that are listening, that psychedelic psychotherapy is an anti-drug approach. We're trying to do in a few sessions to change the baseline of people without drugs. So I think that that same idea, you could use these substances throughout the lifespan, but that doesn't mean you're using them very often.
What are your views here in New Zealand? We're going to this year have a referendum regarding marijuana, whether it should be legal for recreational use. That's alongside medicinal use as well. What are your views on that?
Well, it's about time New Zealand caught up with some of the rest of the world. I would say that, you know, New Zealand was the first country where women could vote. I think it was the first country of gay marriage. But you're behind the times when it comes to legalization of recreational use of marijuana. And so I think it makes a lot of sense that what, you know, marijuana and psychedelics were symbols of this cultural turmoil in the 60s. The drug war has always been about suppressing minorities. In this case, and President Nixon even acknowledged it. And he said that their two main enemies were the civil rights movement and hippies. And you can't go after them for expressing their ideas, but you can go after them for the drugs they use and selectively criminalize those. So the drug war has never been about stopping drug abuse. It's always had ulterior motives. In the U.S., it's used a lot to disenfranchise people from voting. And you make them felons, and now they can't vote. That's the story in Florida and other states. So I'd say to New Zealand that it's a good thing that you're thinking of doing that. It makes a lot of sense. And it doesn't mean that you solve all the problems with the drugs either. The idea is that there's no policy solution that you can apply to drugs that eliminates all the risks and only maximizes benefits. The question is, how do you respond to those people that have trouble with different drugs? And do you respond compassionately with treatment, with honest drug education, with harm reduction methods? Or do you respond punitively with prisons, with misinformation about drugs that nobody can trust, and criminalization of harm reduction? So I think that New Zealand is moving in the right direction, and but people shouldn't have the naive idea that it will solve all problems with marijuana, that people will still, some people will still use it too much, some people will make mistakes while they're under the influence, but there are better approaches to minimizing risks and maximizing benefits than prohibition.
Very interesting. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, Rick. Really appreciate your time.
Sure. My pleasure. Okay.
That's Rick Doblin, and he's speaking about his work with psychedelic drugs, and his TED Talk is called The Future of Psychedelic Assisted Psychotherapy, which you can find online.